From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. Born in the Dominican Republic and raised in New Jersey, Juno Diaz is a seriously big deal author. His book, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2008. His most recent book, This Is How You Lose Her, was a National Book Award finalist. He also received a MacArthur Genius Fellowship and is a professor of writing at MIT. We want to start off with Diaz reading.
This is the opening of The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, and it begins with, "They say it came from Africa, carried in the screams of the enslaved, that it was the death bane of the Tainos, uttered just as one world perished and another began, that it was a demon drawn into creation through the nightmare door that was cracked open in the Antilles. Fuku Americanas, or more colloquially, Fuku, generally understood as a doom or a curse of some kind, specifically the curse and the doom of the New World, also called the Fuku of the Admiral, because the Admiral was both its midwife and one of its great European victims. Despite, in quotes, discovering the New World, the Admiral died miserable and syphilitic, hearing dike divine voices. In Santo Domingo, the land he loved best, what Oscar, at the end, would call the ground zero of the New World. The Admiral's very name has become synonymous with both kinds of fuku, little and bad. To say his name aloud, or even to hear it, is to invite calamity on the heads of you and yours. No matter what its name or its providence, it is believed that the arrival of Europeans on Hispaniola unleashed the fuku on the world, and we have all been in the ever since. Santo Domingo might be fuku's kilometer zero, its port of entry, but we are all of its children, whether we know it or not."
That was author Juno Diaz reading the opening paragraph of his book, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. Diaz visited the University of Missouri in January as the featured speaker for this year's MU Celebrates Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. event. He spoke for more than an hour, so today we're bringing you selections from his talk. Please be aware that this talk covers topics including sexual violence and may not be appropriate for all listeners.
I was born in the Dominican Republic. My work, among many of the things that it wrestles with the often invisible and vigorously disavowed long shadow of enslavement. I'm very much interested in how people like me, who are part of the African diasporic community, and how do we deal with the consequences of the fallout from the calamity that we call slavery? And most specifically, I'm kind of interested in how do bodies like mine that were raped into existence? Yeah, because our community doesn't look the way it looks without systematic rape. Yeah? And so how do communities like ours, with this long history of sexual violence and sexual predation, how do we, as a consequence of that, wrestle with the possibility of intimacy? In other words, where does love reside in bodies that spent centuries being told that they could not partake in love? Yeah, and so I'm very much interested in that. And I think one of the things that we're seeing, of course, probably here more clearly, because this is a super red state, right? I mean, it's kind of fascinating, right? What's happened with the valence around white supremacy? I mean, it's actually kind of bananas, right? It used to be understood that at a kind of a public level, that if you were an open white supremacist, racist, that this would not be celebrated. And we're in such a wild place. One of the things why it's been very revelatory for an artist like me is that we've entered this stage in white supremacy where you can be a full out public racist, and a huge portion of a community thinks that this is a really good idea. And in many ways, it speaks to how sedimented white supremacy has gotten, and how in some ways, like, despite 30, 40, 50 years of anti-white supremacy activism, white supremacy's hold on us is extraordinary. And as an artist, I was always interested in that, and it was almost impossible to have this conversation with people a few years ago, because this has been an important moment for all of us, I think, who are living in this nation, who are living outside of it. Those of us who were, you know, cognizant during the Obama years, we recall how often we were told that somehow white supremacy had gone away and we were now post-racial and y'all people of color need to shut up about past grievances, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, we've discovered something else quite remarkable. Not only that we're not post-racial, but that this undead force of white supremacy continues to haunt and stalk us in ways that we perhaps did not imagine possible.
This is Intersection on KBIA. Today we're hearing from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Juno Diaz.
As someone who is both of African descent and an immigrant, one of the things I think that's become very, very clear and foregrounded in over the past years, and it's perhaps important for all of us to reflect on and try to organize around, is how active one of the, what we would argue, one of the sort of elementary particles of white supremacy has become. And when we think about the way that immigration discourses have been put into motion over this last year, one by necessity has to recall this concept, the coloniality of power, right? All my grad student and undergrad types and professors, coloniality of power, yeah? Yeah, coloniality of power, for those of you who don't know it, look it the hell up, but a way of thinking about it, right? A way of thinking about it is after conquest and enslavement, after that whole set of white people came here and wilded the out, the shock waves of that, the shock waves of colonization and enslavement, the radiation that lives on afterward. And I would say one of what's for me it's gotten really interesting is how just hypertonic has been one of the elements of coloniality of power, which I think it's, for me, it's been useful to think about, which is, of course, this concept that Nelson Maldonado Torres plants, which is this concept of ergo conquiro, right? The way that the conquistador thinks, for shorthand. And at the heart of the epistemologies of the what we would call the formation of the New World is this profound suspicion that is cast upon bodies of African and indigenous descent first, but later on all people of color, this profound suspicion that the conquistador has that people of color are not human. That whether we're talking about Donald Trump and his birther lunacy, or we're talking about the way that immigration is being used to parse who is really human and who is really not, who is really deserving of the largesse of America. At its heart is this logic, this idea that Obama, when Trump was arguing nonstop and rabidly that Obama wasn't an American, really what he was arguing was this very old formation that Obama, as a black man, was really not human. And I think many of us, without knowing it, have acquired this kind of default logic Because we think of this in many, many areas. With immigrants, of course, this is common. You are taught to think of immigrants less worthy of your compassion, less worthy of your sense of what's human. You thought to think apart if they are undocumented 1 degree more. Yeah, and then within our own African diasporic communities, and other communities know this too, we have a calculus within ourselves of what is human. We, even as we're victimized by this logic, we reproduce it. And so, for example, if you come from a bourgeois or a respectable family, you're like, we're human, and those ghetto-ass people ain't. If you're light-skinned and you think that matters to you, you're like, we're human, and those dark-skinned people ain't. If you're an adherent to cultures of respectability, you're like, those of us who marry and have jobs, we're human, but those folks out there who don't got jobs and getting pregnant and wild, they're not human. And at an even smaller and more local level, I see this all the time with my students in the sort of logic of what we call authenticity. How often in the African diasporic community are we eager to disqualify people inside of our community from being in our community through some strange politics of the authentic? In other words, oh, you grew up in a suburb, you ain't black, yo. Your mom is white, you ain't black. Oh, you can't dance? Bueno, tú estás man. And this whole setup of authenticity is a way that not only do we police certain kinds of identities inside of our community, but I think much more toxically is how we reproduce some of the most insidious instruments of white supremacy and carry them around us.
This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Sarah Shariari. You're listening to portions of author Juno Diaz's recent talk at MU. His book, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2008.
But I was saying, we will flip the hell out all day about Donald Trump, but all of the active reservoirs where white supremacy really lives, we scarcely are interested in pursuing, examining, exploding them. We're not all really that interested in decolonizing our erotics, right? We'll talk all day about how people like lighter-skinned people, but ultimately, we ain't really gonna get in there, right, and talk about how deeply colonized our system of desire is, and how our system of desire is far more aligned with Trump than any of us want to say. Yeah, I mean, I remember my thing was when I went to college, I still remember my first year at college when it suddenly dawned on me, I was like, oh, so college is where black and Latino people go to meet white people. Because that's what it seemed like to me when I got in. And I was like, wow, so that's what this is, yo. In many different areas, we have to begin to think about this decolonial stance, this decolonial practice. Because, yo, we will get rid of Trump. Let's say in some fantasy land, we vote him out. But we've done absolutely nothing to root out the subterranean and not so subterranean sources of his power. What's really at stake at this is I am not certain if all of the ire that we have to Trump, we actually would be willing to direct to the secret power that holds these societies together, which is the way that white supremacy lives inside of all of us. We do not like its most odious and malignant manifestations, but we actually do seem quite comfortable with the way that it resides inside of us. And I'm speaking for me personally. As an artist, I've always been interested in this. Because for me, white supremacy as just a kind of sensational or a kind of an obvious or a kind of a materialized sets of oppression is one thing, but how it lives inside of you and how we kind of gleefully pursue it even as we deny that this is happening. It is here where the artist can enter and can begin to do some of that work. There is much about this infinite agony that we call white supremacy that we're only beginning to understand. But certainly, as we are struggling against it as a material historical force, we must simultaneously begin to address its internal commandments. And its commandments are many, and they are quite horrifying.
This is Intersection on KBIA. Today we're hearing from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Junot Diaz.
But when we think about liberation struggles against white supremacy, if we limit ourselves to the Black Panthers, which I think it's good to know about the Black Panthers, we begin to forget that there were Black movements all over the Caribbean that literally confronted an armed struggle American empire. That there was armed Blackness throughout the Caribbean that fought American white supremacy. And these lost cartographies of our resistance to American empire have been lost and require recuperation. And it doesn't help us in creating the kind of solidarities that we need to create with each other. Part of the reason why Blackness is so fragmented in this country is because the amnesia that empire inflicts on us allows us to forget the connections we have with each other, how in the past we fought with and for, we fought for each other. To misunderstand how Cuba and the Philippines resisted the Spanish together, how Asian Americans traveled down to Cuba in the War of Independence in 1895 to fight for the liberation of a Black Cuban state. All of these things have been lost and chased into the corners of our minds, and we've got to figure out ways to put it back. It is a full-time damn job. But the thing about amnesia is that a little bit of remembering goes a long damn way. That this is an empire with all the energy and all the power, and it will inflict forgetting on you. If you just remember one thing, it's more than most of us will ever have. And we continually have to fight against it. Even those of us who make this the center focus of our studies, of our art, of our scholarship, it is so easy for the amnesia to roll in. We sit across each other in classes and we don't even know how much we have in common. Those of us in the African diaspora look at Asian Americans and we're completely scrambled around how we labored and struggled together across the globe for our liberations. And the same is true for Indigenous. It is a remarkable history that we have, but it's all been either erased or hidden. We've got to start thinking about our old solidarities, which will lead us to new solidarities. If we think we're doing this for the first time, it's going to be hard. But we're not doing this for the first time.
This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Sarah Shariari. You're listening to portions of author Junot Diaz's recent talk at MU. His book, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2008.
We all have privilege. If the only narrative that we have for ourselves is that I am disenfranchised, all that does is mask the immense privilege that you have vis-a-vis other groups. Yes, we are disenfranchised in certain contexts, but we're also empowered in other contexts. If the only map you have of yourself is what you don't have vis-a-vis white people, you've got some weird maps. all of us have immense privilege, and all of us need to understand that this privilege must be used, or I would say should be used, towards liberation and not towards the perpetuation of systems of privilege. There is no person here who doesn't have privilege vis-a-vis another community. And it is so easy to focus on the privilege you don't have, because that is what privilege does. Whether you are a light-skinned person that no one thinks is black, or you're blackity-blackity-black, y'all, you got privilege. And if you are unwilling to simultaneously make that visible as you're discussing your disenfranchisement, how different are you from folks who don't ever want to confront privilege at all? And so that, to me, is what's at stake. Yeah? Your privilege is there to help other people's liberation, not for you to perpetuate it.
This is Intersection on KBIA. Today we're hearing from Pulitzer Prize-winning author Juno Diaz.
I was talking to a group of young people earlier, and I think you know this. You know this, yeah? If your hope requires evidence, you know it's not hope. Yeah. One of the things that I draw from the kind of corny books I grew up reading that are useful, I was talking to this group of people and I said, listen, I always feel like Gandalf in this term. There's this moment in The Lord of the Rings where Gandalf says, you have no right to despair. The only person who can despair is he or she who can see all ends. And since none of us can see all ends, we cannot despair. Yeah, we are not omnipotent. I think despair is a way of not doing the necessary work. Hey, this ain't gonna be easy. This fight is gonna be the worst. And what we've experienced so far doesn't even begin to touch what we're gonna have to do to get really free. We are going to have to fight all the way down. Even as the light is going out and all hope is lost, we have to keep punching. We must fight and fight and fight. There is no other way. And I do think, I'll leave you with this, I do think it is important to recall that one of the new spells that this empire has cast upon us, one of its newer demonic incantations, is this tremendous sense of fear that most of us feel. Now, those of us who are materialists and structuralists, we understand that one of neoliberalism's consequences has been this permanent state of precarity. I walk into a classroom with my young people, and do you know what the first thing I feel coming off of them in waves is? Fear. These are the brightest, smartest young people in the world. These are the people at MIT who've got the whole world at their feet. And yet all of they have been taught and what they have been weaned is a neoliberal precarity. That the future is dark. The future is dystopian. If you make one mistake, you won't get a job. If you have the wrong major, you won't get a job. You won't have what your parents have. You're never going to get out of debt. You're never going to go around a house. You better compete. You better compete. You better compete. And this is what we've been weaned on. When you feel fear nonstop, you cannot think straight. When you feel fear nonstop, you make really bad choices about how you will deal with your future. When you feel fear nonstop, you can't connect with yourself and you cannot connect with others. This has been one of the most insidious conditions which we operate under. Most of us are up to our eyeballs in fear and we don't even know what it means. When I tell my undergraduates, my God, there's so much fear in this room, they're like, what fear? Because they have grown up with it, that it's become naturalized. It's the water that they swim in. And we radiate and communicate this with each other. We are held together by this neoliberal fear. And this guarantees that we won't fight as hard as we need to fight. This guarantees that we will take no risks. This guarantees that young people, you amazing young people with your transformative energy that could take this planet out of orbit, will act like you're old before your time. Fear is not only, as they say in science fiction books, the mind killer. Fear is the youth killer. We have transformed a generation of young people into a generation of old people with very little cost to the empire. We must fight that, because we will never create solidarities in atmospheres and condition of fear. And young people, if you understand that this is the sea in which you swim, you can begin to resist. You can begin to manage your fear. You can begin to do things that help you punch your way through it. The day that young people feel more their strength and their power than they feel fear, everything that we call this world will change.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning author Junot Diaz. He was recently the featured speaker for this year's MU Celebrates Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. event. Thank you for joining us here on Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. And thank you to MU's MLK Jr. Celebration Committee and to Junot Diaz. If you'd like to listen to this show again, you can visit us online at kbia.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where we are at Intersect KBIA. Our producers are Abby Ivory Gagna, Elena Rivera, Aviva Oxen-Haberman, Haley Broughton, and Hannah Rodriguez. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection here at KBIA 91.3 FM.